Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Welcome back. It is now or never. That debt is fraud. And you hear us harping and talking, you know, about people holding themselves accountable. Folks, we need to start supporting those people that are actually standing up and saying, I am running a campaign. This is not about me. It's about the Constitution. I ask you to open your wallets and hearts and help and support and sustain these people who are signing these pledges, i.e. Jerry Wistrand, who is running for the auditor of Missouri, is the one that said, I'm running a campaign on the Constitution. I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to do my job as the auditor, but my focus is ensuring that the Constitution is complied with in every capacity, in every way possible. That's what we need, and we need him in that seat. Watch what happens when all of a sudden we have a mouthpiece at the state level and within the state houses within your county that are champions of the Constitution. I'm not talking about just being contrary people. I'm talking about actually demanding full compliance to the Constitution. Okay, so all that being said, it's about giving you the content so that you have the full insight of what this stuff means. We're watching everything start to evolve within the Constitutional Convention. It takes time. It's going to take time to go through this so that you can see, you know, what these hang-ups were and how some of these persisting hang-ups were hard to give up. And in some ways, many of these men didn't give them up because they were men of that character, not willing to concede that they're wrong and that this was the better way. Or they may vote the right way just because of social pressures, but as they functioned in their normal life, they still felt this differently. They didn't want to be called out because once it's been proven irrefutable that this is a superior process than anything else, like the Electoral College, then you really can't, I mean, you become the fool because you voted against it. It's almost like what ended up happening with George Mason, a brilliant man that became a fool because he said, I'd rather cut off my right arm than sign this Constitution. And we kind of talked about his motives behind that. So, welcome back, Tammy. And are you ready to dive into, oh, let me just say this, folks. It's all about full compliance with the Constitution. This is why we give you this content, and this is why we constantly remind you to basically learn, pray, and act. If you're inclined to be and participate in a, you know, a prayer group or what have you, please start one. Or participate in the Loud and Liberty, because Woody Kay leads off with the Loud and Liberty group, and they have a daily prayer praying for those people who are becoming champions of the Constitution. It's a worthy cause. Not only a worthy cause, it's the cause we all need to be involved in. So let me just say that, and let's dive into the content at hand. Now, we wrapped up with the discussion over the state, or I should say the federal higher house, what we know becomes the Senate. And just a little while longer on, you know, maybe the next day, actually, what ends up happening is that Mr. Patterson kind of, you know, throws the challenge flag up and says, hey, you know, we have a duty to, you know, what we're supposed to be doing, what our state expects us to do. And so Mr. Patterson, and actually let me let you know what state he's from, because understanding what state they're from would kind of help you understand whether they're speaking specifically to those states that actually had, I'll basically say, actually had some real reservations on what they were going to do. And so William Patterson was New Jersey. They had no true reservations. They kind of had a blank check. But still, he felt inclined to say, hey, you know, we need to focus on what we're really here to do. And so I'll let you go ahead, Tammy, and kind of, you know, chew this away. There's going to be some comments regarding this because Mr. Patterson comes off with this, you know, long oration. Mr. Wilson then speaks, and then Mr. Williamson, you know. So they kind of spend a good part of the day focused on their commission and what they're supposed to do. So go ahead. Let's dive into this. Thank you so much.
Mr. Patterson considered the proposition for a proportional representation as striking at the existence of the lesser states. He would premise, however, to an investigation of this question, some remarks on the nature, structure, and powers of the convention. The convention, he said, was formed in pursuance of an act of Congress, that this act was recited in several of the commissions, particularly that of Massachusetts, which he required to be read, that the amendment of the Confederacy was the object of all the laws and commissions on the subject, that the Articles of the Confederation were therefore the proper basis of all the proceedings of the convention. We ought to keep within its limit, or we should be charged by our constituents with usurpation, that the people of America were sharp-sighted and not to be deceived. But the commissions under which we acted were not only the measure of our power, they denoted also the sentiments of the states on the subject of our deliberation. The idea of a national government as contradistinguished from a federal one never entered into the mind of any of them, and to the public mind we must accommodate ourselves. We have no power to go beyond the federal scheme, and if we had, the people are not ripe for any other. We must follow the people will not follow us. Proposition could not be maintained whether considered in reference to us as a nation or as a confederacy.
So let me stop you right there.
Okay.
I'm going to go back because he's from New Jersey, but he asked and pointed particularly to the Commission of Massachusetts, one of the only two out of the 13. That stated, hey, we want to make sure you maintain fidelity to the Articles of Confederation in this particular capacity, blah, blah, blah. In other words, it wasn't, you know, this huge, you know, we must keep all of these things. They only wanted to make sure, and if you want, folks, we could pull it back up, but just go back and listen, because we covered this. So the point is why is he going into this conniption of changing the form of government or the form of this general government? Now, let's keep in mind that there you have the form of government and then you have the power delegated to that government. If there are problems that you cannot basically vest the national government in a handful of 20 men, because it was already identified as a part of the amendments that they needed to be able to hire people to basically do administrative functions. They needed, you know, help and support. They were mere men, and when you start controlling 13 different states, you know, at a high, you may be able to make the decisions, but if you don't have people to do the legwork, guess who gets to do it? And I pity the poor fool that thinks that as this union grows, that the small, parsed representation was going to be adequate. So they wanted to make sure that they could actually perform the functions, because part of the functions is collecting taxes. Part of the function is actually creating laws, you know, such as the militia laws and those types of things, to where the federal government is capable of doing the things that the states asked it to do. I'm interrupting because I know that he is reaching, and I think that there's a reason for this. I'm not sure I'd have to do the due diligence, but Mr. Patterson might be one of those anti-federalists that really wanted to kind of protect the state cabals, because why else would he point to another state bigger than his that had some reservations where his state, he couldn't point to his state's commission? Or he would have, correct? Because right here, he says this. The convention, he said, was formed in pursuance of an act of Congress, that this act was recited in the several of the commissions, particularly that of Massachusetts, which he required to be read. Why didn't he read New Jersey's? Oh, because they didn't have the constraints at all. See my point? So he's kind of creating this drama, which really feeds well for the, you know, the John Birchers or those people that want to talk about a runaway convention. But when you go through, because we already covered this, folks, we covered it at a high level, but please go through the eight amendments to the Articles of Confederation so that you can understand how inept and impotent they were. They literally needed to make all these types of changes so that the government could truly function in doing the things that the states needed it to do for them. Managing trade coming in. You know, this small little cadre of Continental Congress, you couldn't expect them to be able to do that. So should Congress be the enforcers? What ended up happening? And I've talked about this as a scope of a magistrate government. Continental Congress was a magistrate government where you had the body of these representatives who were the executive, they were the legislatures, and they were the judiciary. And if necessary, they would appoint a judiciary or appoint the, and they would actually have to go off on, you know, a regular occasion to have to say, okay, we need to find somebody over in this area to do this. When it comes to trade coming in, whether it be from Savannah, Georgia, or all the way up to, you know, Kittybunkport, Maine, as the union on the East Coast starts forming and we actually start filling in maybe a couple of these little gaps like Maine, they know that they're going to get commerce coming in, and who's supposed to be there inspecting it and making sure that the regulations are being followed? The federal government has to be there. But if you don't account for that, you don't basically create an executive branch to control, to execute those laws, to ensure the enforcement of those laws, then this Congress has to do it. And that becomes insane. So the whole point is that what these men were really doing, what Madison was proposing, was a government that would be far more efficacious in doing what the states really needed it to do. They weren't playing this patty cake game of holding back, and only giving them what would be perceived as adequate. Because that's what the cabals wanted. Let's make it seem like it's adequate enough to do the job, but it would still fail. And here Madison came out with this plan that said, this is precisely the things that would not only be adequate, necessary for them to do their job. And if people could actually argue, so if Mr. Patterson could actually start arguing why these things aren't necessary, that currently the configuration of the government was adequate, then that would be a different case. But he's not. He's protecting the status quo. He's protecting something. And so as I hear you reading this, it jumps into my paradigm that this guy's really an anti-federalist. Maybe his heart changes towards this. I haven't done the research on him particularly. But when we watch what happens in New Jersey rubber stamped the Constitution. Rubber stamped it. Was he really representing New Jersey by making this diatribe, you know, on, hey, we're not, you know, living to the spirit of what we're supposed to be doing here? And, I'd love to have seen whether he was called out by the state legislature to say, you know, why did you do that? Because again, New Jersey practically rubber stamped the Constitution in ratifying it. They didn't challenge it. Interesting. Just things to point out. So keep going. Back to the Confederation.
Okay. The Confederacy supposes sovereignty in the members composing it, and sovereignty supposes equality. If we are to be considered as a nation, all state distinctions must be abolished. The whole must be thrown into hot pot. And when an equal division is made, then there may be fairly an equality of representation. He held up Virginia, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania as the three large states and the other 10 as small ones. Repeating the calculations of Mr. Brearley as to the disparity of votes which would take place and affirming that the small states would never agree to it. He said there was no more reason that a great individual state contributing much should have more votes than a small one contributing little than that a rich individual citizen should have more votes than an indigent one. If the ratable property of A was to that of B as 40 to 1, ought A for that reason to have 40 times as many votes as B? Such a principle would never be admitted, and if it were admitted, would put B entirely at the mercy of A, as A has more to be protected than B, so he ought to contribute more for the common protection. The same may be said of a large state, which has more to be protected than a small one. Give the large states an influence in proportion to their magnitude, and what will be the consequence? Their ambition will be proportionally increased, and the small states will have everything to fear. It was once proposed by Galloway and some others that America should be represented in the British Parliament and then be bound by its laws. America could not have been entitled to more than one-third of the number of representatives which would fall to the shares of Great Britain. To the share of Great Britain. Would American rights and interests have been safe under an authority thus constituted? It has been said that if a national government is to be formed so as to operate on the people and not on the states, representatives ought to be drawn from the people. But why so? May not a legislature filled by the state legislatures operate on the people who choose the state legislatures? Or may not a practicable coercion be found? He admitted that there was none such in the existing system. He was attached strongly to the plan of the existing Confederacy in which the people choose their legislative representatives and the legislature their federal representatives. No other amendments were wanting than to mark the orbits of the states with due precision and provide for the use of coercion, which was the great point. He alluded to the hint thrown out, therefore, by Mr. Wilson of the necessity to which the large states might be reduced as confederating among themselves by a refusal of the others to concur. Let them unite if they please, but let them remember that they have no authority to compel the others to unite. New Jersey will never confederate on the plan before the committee. She would be swallowed up. He had rather submit to a monarch, to a despot, than to such a fate. He would not only oppose the plan here, but on his return home, do everything in his power to defeat it here.
To defeat it there, right. Okay. All right, so now Mr. Wilson, because his name came up, Mr. Wilson kind of opined or responded. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson hoped if the Confederacy should be dissolved that a minority of the states would unite for their safety. He entered elaborately into the defense of the proportional representation, stating for his first position that as all authority was derived from the people, equal numbers of people ought to have an equal number of representatives. And the different numbers of people, different numbers of representatives. This principle had been improperly violated in the Confederation owing to the urgent circumstances of the time. As to the case of A and B, stated by Mr. Patterson, he observed that in districts as large as the states, the number of people was the best measure of their comparative wealth. Whether, therefore, wealth or numbers were, to form the ratio would be the same. Mr. Patterson admitted persons, not property, to be the measure of suffrage. Are not the citizens of Pennsylvania equal to those of New Jersey? Does it require 150 of the former to balance 50 of the latter? Representatives of different districts ought clearly to hold the same proportion to each other as their respective constituents hold to each other. If the small states will not confederate on this plan, Pennsylvania, and he presumed some other states, would not confederate on any other. We have been told that each state being sovereign, all are equal. So each man is naturally a sovereign over himself, and all men are therefore naturally equal. Can he retain this equity when he becomes a member of civil government? He cannot. As little can a state sovereign state when it becomes a member of a federal government. If New Jersey will not part with her sovereignty, it is vain to talk of government. A new partition of the states is desirable, but evidently and totally impractical.
Okay, so interestingly enough, we have this kind of in yellow. And so I'm trying to find out, I believe it's right here in the fifth line up at the very end. It says, so each man is naturally a sovereign of himself, and all men are sovereign, therefore naturally equal. He can retain this equality when he becomes a member of a civil government. He cannot, or can he maintain, can he retain this equality when he becomes a member of civil government? He cannot. As little can a sovereign state when it becomes a member of a federal government. If New Jersey, so I'm trying to find out, because he was talking about sovereignty, and I think it starts right there. And anyway, he says, if New Jersey will not part with her sovereignty, it is in vain to talk of government. A new partition of states is desirable, but eventually, or evidently, and totally impracticable. The reality is he's pointing out the two sovereigns. It doesn't jump out, but it is a fact that when people come together and they create a government and empower that government to make decisions of very, give them the power to do things for them, it becomes a sovereign over those things delegated. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the state or the county becomes a sovereign based on the sovereignty of the people who have surrendered their powers and say over these specific things and delegated that to that local government. When the state then gets created, these counties move forward if they understand the position and propriety of being a sovereign for those people that have basically empowered them. Then they would form a government that would protect both their sovereignty as well as the people's sovereignty. This is not the natural deduction of man. The natural deduction of man is to protect myself. Most people don't think in the realms of, you know, the civil society, that we have actually created a distribution of sovereignty. And if we do not give government its due, then why did we create it? We were already seeing the ineptness and failures of the Articles of Confederation with the Continental Congress. It was impotent and inept. Are your counties impotent and inept? Absolutely. Why? Because you never created them. You never delegated the power to them to tell them this is how we want you to govern us. So that when they went to create the states, they had no idea who they were. They didn't know. There was no way they would have come to the conclusion that we're representing a sovereign body of people, individuals, as well as a group of people as a government. Ergo, we need to create a bicameral legislative body that protects both the government of the people as well as protecting the people in that government. Therefore, so when we see this, and we're going into a break here. So as we see this, this is the whole point I am telling, I'm trying to educate people on American republicanism. Republicanism is not representation of the people or the people being sovereign. It is a representation of the sovereigns, of the people and the governments that they create as sovereign, so that the next government created will recognize and actually represent both sovereigns. This is why it's important. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as I was kind of going into the break to kind of help point this out, folks, we have a very unique hybrid Republican form of government because we actually have three republics. We, the people, create the small republic that is actually going to govern our day-to-day affairs. That is your local government. And then we create a general government to basically protect the sovereignty of the people and their local government, their county government, and basically ensure that there's an even playing field for all these people and all the governments. Just because the people on the ports and along the sea, you know, the seashore, may gather there may be more people there. It doesn't mean that the wood that they build their house with is not as equally important as the fish that they're pulling out of the sea and getting, you know, because there's more people and they're making more money. No. This is why we create governments that have their hands tied, that can't create favoritism towards one county due to its riches, due to, you know, its population, due to any factor other than the fact that it is a county within the republic. They're all equal. That was the whole point here, and this is the lesson we need to take away, that these small counties, these small states, I should say, just like counties based in population, they deserve that equal representation in the Senate. They will not get equal representation in the House, because if we go by 1,700 people like New Hampshire, obviously the populated counties are going to have a lot more representation for their people. But what is the people's interest? Well, the people's interest is, when it comes to government, is the taxes that they're going to pay, because that's, you know, appropriation always comes out of the people or out of the House. At least that's this ingenious way that they divided the responsibilities. And one of the other major concerns was whether we went to war or not, so that the House of Representatives would actually have that say over that and stop us from having to go to war if we don't want to go to war. In other words, it serves our interests. The government's interest, or I should say our county government's interest, is going to be different than that. You know, how can we get more businesses to come and set up in our counties? How can we develop our county in, you know, revenue purposes, work, so forth and so on? Anyway, this is the brilliance of this form of Republican form of government. By ensuring nobody can dominate, because when somebody can dominate, they will, and they will do it with a heavy hand. When you give anyone authority over others, power over others, the tendency is always that they will basically engage in what we would call unrighteous dominion. In other words, they will start creating the favors for those who, you know, help them get to this position of power, and they will literally start creating oppression and oppressing the little people. They've kind of covered this historically already. This is just, you know, stating the obvious. So framing a government and getting it right, the fact that they did this truly is divine, because the way they were arguing and so forth, and even with Mr. Patterson, the way he, you know, wanted to use this, you know, this commission of Massachusetts as the example. Well, bottom line is, if what they created wasn't going to become an acceptable government for New Jersey and all the rest of the small states, then they wouldn't have joined. The only states that had a problem, the only states that contended and had a contest against the Constitution, were the big states. Why? Because they weren't going to have the level of control that they wanted. They were giving up control. And they didn't like that. And they wanted to protect their control, their money, their cabal. Bottom line, that's why everything went down the way it did. And when it came down to putting the case out, putting the argument out, whether this was a better government or not, had they left it to the state legislatures, the big states would have rejected the Constitution. So what did they do to basically give the Constitution the best opportunity possible? Is they called upon Continental Congress to have the states debate the Constitution in a convention of the people. Not as a democratic convention, but the people would choose their representative to decide whether they were going to accept a government or not. So everybody kind of understands this. They did everything they could to ensure that these cabals had very little ability to protect themselves and to have the control the outcome to where they would have killed and squashed the Constitution. Brilliant. This, everything that happened was absolutely brilliant. Anyway, so Mr. Williamson adds these 2 cents, and so let's go ahead and just add this, and then we can go down to the next pertinent point that we kind of want to cover. Go ahead.
Mr. Williamson illustrated the cases by comparison of the different states, counties of different sizes within the same state, observing that proportional representation was admitted to be just in the latter case and could not therefore be fairly contested in the former. Question being about to be put, Mr. Patterson hoped that as so much depended on it, it might be thought best to postpone the decision till tomorrow, which was done with no contest. And then the House adjourned.
Ah, okay. So... Interesting. Here he basically makes the same case for the counties, and yet they, when they formed into their new government, they still didn't embody those same protections for their county government. And I mean that because nobody ever created a constitution for their county. Nobody ever empowered their county to ensure that the state government would lose even more powers and that the powers would be closer to the people. I mean, he's making the inference here that, hey, this is all, I mean, it's proper for this and for this. You can't say that the counties, it's best to do it that way, but not with the states. In other words, representing the sovereigns, making sure that the sovereigns had equality with population for the people, and equality for presence of the counties, because the counties weren't based on, you know, population. The counties were based on government. So 1-to-1. When it comes to apportionment of the people, that would be based on population. So anyway, here you have it right here, that they already identified that they acknowledged that this was the proper practice for counties. Why wouldn't they use the same proper practice in the states as well, maintaining the sovereignty of the states individually and giving the people representation by population? Anyway, all right, so this goes down to the committee report on the next day. So the next day they meet and they kind of kick things off and warm things up a little bit with a little comment here, comment there, comment here. And then Mr. Wilson starts the committee report for the body of the whole, or for the entire convention. So let's let's see what they're actually reporting. What did this committee, this subcommittee, go do that they're making these report and suggestions? So let's go ahead.
So Mr. Wilson then read to the committee in the words following, "Mr. Chairman, it has given me great pleasure to observe that till this point the proportion of representation came before us, our debates were carried on with great coolness and temper. If anything of a contrary kind has on this occasion appeared, I hope it will not be repeated. For we are sent here to consult, not to contend with each other. A declarations of a fixed opinion and of determined resolution never to change it, neither enlighten or convince us. Positiveness and warmth on one side naturally beget their like on the other, and tend to create and augment discord and division in a great concern, wherein harmony and union are extremely necessary to give weight to our counsels and render them effectual in promoting and securing the common good. I must own that I was originally of opinion it would be better if every member of Congress or National Council were to consider himself rather as a representative of the whole than as an agent for the interest of a particular state, in which case the proportion of members for each state would be of less consequence, and it would not be very material whether they voted by states or individually. But as I find this is not to be expected, I now think the number of representatives should bear some proportion to the number of the represented, and that the decision should be by the majority of members, not by the majority of the states. This is objected to from an apprehension that the greater states would then swallow up the smaller. I do not at present clearly see what advantage the greater states could propose to themselves by swallowing the smaller, and therefore do not apprehend they would attempt it. I recollect that in the beginning of this century, when the union was proposed of the two kingdoms, England and Scotland, the Scotch patriots were full of fears that unless they had an equal number of representatives in Parliament, they should be ruined by the superiority of the English. They finally agreed, however, that the different proportions of importance in the union of the two nations should be attended to, whereby they were to have only 40 members in the House of Commons and only 16 in the House of Lords, a very great inferiority of numbers. And yet to this day I do not recollect that anything has been done in the Parliament of Great Britain to the prejudice of Scotland, and whoever looks over the list of public officers, civil and military, of that nation will find, I believe, that the North Britons enjoy at least their full proportions of emolument. But, sir, in the present mode of voting by states, it is equally in the power of the lesser states to swallow up the greater, and this is mathematically demonstrable. Suppose, for example, that seven smaller states had each three members in the House and six and the six larger to have one with another six members, and that upon a question, two members of each smaller state should be in an affirmation and one in the negative, they will make affirmatives 14, negative 7, and that all the larger states should be unanimously in the negative, they would make negative 36, in all, 43. You want me to keep going?
Yeah, keep on going, yeah. Because he's laying out this theory of how this math would work out. Go ahead.
Okay. It is then apparent that the 14 carry the question against the 43, and the minority overpowers the majority contrary to the common practice of assemblies in all the countries and ages. The greater states, sir, are naturally as unwilling to have their property left in the disposition of the smaller as the smaller are to have theirs in the disposition of the greater. An honorable gentleman has, to avoid this difficulty, hinted a proposition of equalizing the states. It appears to me an equitable one, and I should, for my own part, not be against such a measure if it might be found practicable. Formerly, indeed, when almost every province had a different constitution, some with greater, others with fewer privileges, it was of importance to the borderers when their boundaries were contested, whether by running the division lines they were placed on one side or the other. At present, when such differences are done away, it is less material. The interest of a state is made up of the interests of its individual members. If they are not injured, the state is not injured. Small states are more easily well and happily governed than large ones. If therefore in such an equal division it should be found necessary to diminish Pennsylvania, I should not be adverse to the giving a part of it to New Jersey and another to Delaware. But as there would probably be considerable difficulties in adjusting such a division, and however equally made at first, it would be continually varying by the augmentation of inhabitants in some states and their fixed proportion in others, and thence frequent occasion for new divisions, I beg leave to propose for the consideration of the committee another mode, which appears to me to be as equitable, more easily carried into practice, and more permanent in its nature. Let the weakest state say what proportion of money or force it is able and willing to furnish for the general purposes of the Union. Let all the others oblige themselves to furnish each an equal proportion. The whole of these joint supplies to be absolutely in the disposition of Congress. The Congress in this case to be composed of an equal number of delegates from each state, and their decision to be by the majority of an individual member's voting. If these joint and equal supplies should in particular occasions not be sufficient, let Congress make requisitions on the richer and more powerful states for farther aid to be voluntarily afforded, leaving to each state the right of considering the necessity and utility of the aid desired and of giving more or less as it should be found proper.
Okay, keep going.
This mode is not new. It was formerly practiced with success by the British government with respect to Ireland and the colonies. We sometimes gave even more than they expected or thought just to accept. And in the last war carried on while we were united, they gave us back in 5 years of £1 million. We should probably have continued such voluntary contributions whenever the occasions appeared to require them for the common good of the empire. It was not till they chose to force us and to deprive us of the merit and pleasure of voluntary contributions that we refused and resisted. Those contributions, however, were to be disposed of at the pleasure of the government in which we had no representatives. I am therefore persuaded that they will not be refused to one in which the representations shall be equal. My learned colleague, Mr. Wilson, has already mentioned that the present method of voting by states was submitted to originally by Congress under a conviction of its impropriety, inequality, and injustice. This appears in the words of the resolution. It is of September 6, 1774. The words are, resolved that in determining questions of this Congress, each colony or province shall have one vote. The Congress, not being possessed of or at present able to procure materials for ascertaining the importance of each colony.
Okay.
On the question for agreeing to Mr. King's and Mr. Wilson's motion, it passed in the affirmative.
Okay. So, so when you kind of look to this point, what the case he was making, he was basically trying to point out that when the smaller states, you know, they have a majority already. In other words, right now, when you look at just in size by population and so forth, and let me see if I can pull it up. I can pull it up, but I'll just have to do it this way. Because when we look, what I'm going to do is I'm pulling up the original state population. In other words, as I look at the different states as far as population goes, and let me see, I'll go ahead and smallest to largest. So as I look at the first, what are these, seven? Yeah, there's the first seven states are less than 300,000. That includes South Carolina. It includes Connecticut. It includes New Jersey. It includes New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Georgia, as well as Delaware. Now, that's just the smaller states at that point. But when you really look at what I would consider the true smaller states, because when we look at Maryland, did Maryland ratify the Constitution without any reservations? Absolutely. Maryland actually ratified without any reservations. South Carolina actually had reservations, and the reason they, and if you look at the ratification base, it was all about slavery. So all things being equal, there's never a point in time where the only thing government is going to do is talk about slavery, right? So you'll actually find that based on whoever holds the majority on the particular matter, whether it be demographics such as slavery, you know, and so forth, or whether it be labor, or whether it be industry, agriculture, factories, what have you, whoever has the majority will always be able to create the advantage. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if we're currently looking, right now, we're still looking at having two separate legislative bodies that do not have checks and balances on each other. And still moving forward, what that means is that states would be more susceptible to oppression by continuing this practice of basic equality. In other words, each state would have its own vote. Separating the interests from the people and the functions of the government, i.e., you know, the job making, you know, revenues, taxation, those things, by separating those things completely and giving the states equal say over that, and then giving the states a portion of, based on population, the say over the things that are concerning to the people, now you're truly creating a check and balance where it would never really be, you know, a majority trampling on the, because this is where the people themselves would constantly give themselves what they wanted. But if you have a Senate that is maintaining the interest of businesses and so forth, they're not going to want to actually give the people what they want, because bottom line, the interest, because 9 times out of 10, the interest of one, it comes against the interest of the other. If the people want to have, you know, their own homes and they want government to give them a home, then it comes at the expense of the other body. In other words, the employers, or where that money and the origins of the financing is coming from. Because if that basically saying that, hey, we can't afford them ourselves, so build them for us. And they vote for that. That is always at the expense of somebody else. And that other body being represented would literally be that body that would be represented by those state or county governments. As they created this argument, they still haven't felt, they haven't, I don't think that they have created the cookie cutter, the perfect form in understanding by separating both of these. Mr. Wilson, as far as I'm concerned, he is in the paradigm that he believes a democracy and the people should have the say. When you go through the ratification debates, he still basically preaches those same things. Even though he's in favor of the Constitution, he's in favor of it because it does extend power to the people. And you'll, and when we go through these things, you'll actually see these things going, wow, I mean, okay. So he puts this positive spin on the power to the people and how these things, you know, will maintain, you know, the people's interests and so forth. Where some of these others, like slavery and these other things, actually, he even points out, Wilson even points out, that the compromises made for slavery will actually work against the southern states. Because in the Pennsylvania debates, he says that slavery will eventually, based on these compromises, slavery will eventually, we're not ending it immediately today like we would like to, but it will eventually end because of these compromises. There's not a lot of people that are saying that. So interestingly enough, as you look at how these guys' paradigms work and how they were really focused, at least Wilson was constantly focused on the say of the people, the democracy, we the people have the power. And so I don't think he garnered what was being said by Gary and some of these other folks that, you know, we actually have, you know, these conflicting sovereigns. We create government. We can't conflict with their sovereignty, or we're basically destroying our own governments that we've created. When you give them the power, you've got to enable them the power. When you put somebody in charge of something and you don't let them have the power to do it, how do you expect them to succeed? Anyway, so I digress. Let's go back into, because we got about 2.5 minutes. Let's see if we can kind of finish what we've got here, because we just kind of covered that Massachusetts, yes, Connecticut, yes, New York, no, New Jersey, no, Pennsylvania, yes, Delaware, no, Maryland was divided, so no vote, Virginia, yes, North Carolina, yes, South Carolina, yes, and Georgia, yes. So it's basically 7-3. So, in other words, in the affirmative, it passed, like it says. Go ahead and leave this last one.
Okay. It was then moved by Mr. Rutledge, seconded by Mr. Butler, to add the words equitable racial representation at the end of the motion thus agreed to, the words according to the quotas of contribution. On the motion of Mr. Wilson, seconded by Mr. C. Pickney, this was postponed in order to add after the words equitable racial representation. The words following, in proportion to the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants of every age, sex, and condition, including those bound to servitude for a term of years, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, except Indians not paying taxes in each state. This being the rule of the Act of Congress agreed to by 11 states for apportioning quotas of revenue on the states and requiring a census only every 5 to 7 or 10 years.
Okay, so this is the first time we hear about a compromise of 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended. They're talking about slaves here. So in other words, this is Mr. Pickney of South Carolina that wants to make sure that if they're going to have a apportionment for people, because South Carolina is one of the lower populated states. So they want to make sure that they, you know, bolster up their population by counting their slaves. Because when you start filling up the land and you've basically got just a few people on this large piece of land that is growing food or making you your money, and the majority of the people on that land are the people that are going to be working that, the slaves, well, you're going to want to get those people counted. Because when you look at agrarian states, the whole state gets taken up by farming, which means that your proportion of blacks and whites are fixed, and fixed in a way that you want to take advantage of, you know, all of the slaves that you have. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get their bread buttered on both sides. This becomes the long-term argument over this 3/5 rule, and it becomes a long argument. Any comments?
Nope.
Okay, because if you do, we're almost out of time. Let's do a go back. By all means, if there's something that's come up that you've read or we've talked or I may have expounded upon that made no sense at all, then by all means, just bring it up as a go back. And so with that, folks, we will do that when Tammy comes back, which would probably be in a day or two, because I don't think she'll be in our next show. But anyway, all that being said, we're covering the facts for you so that you can actually see how this really does evolve and how it takes time seeping into these men's heads. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.